Welcome back everyone to another episode of the Damage Report. I briefly thought it was Friday. I got a little bit excited. It's not though, it's Thursday. But we're gonna press forward with a ton of news. Not only are we gonna be closing out the show in the way that we like to on Thursdays with Meanwhile In, we've got big news from literally around the world, but also from the moon, from a different world, and from Greenland. Some really scary environmental news that we're gonna be closing the show with. But along the way, we've got an activist who's gonna be talking about her arrest, an animal rights activist. We've got authoritarianism on the rise here in America. We've got Donald Trump not paying his police bills while claiming to be in favor of police. We've got his campaign against Fox News, which has entered its newest phase with the newest front, I guess, would be his war against Shep Smith in particular, which Shep Smith responded to. That's perhaps the most delightful thing that we're gonna show you on the show today. But before we get to all that, and there's a ton of news, there's a ton of guests, we wanna start off with what I previewed on Twitter this morning as one of the scariest stories that I've had to cover in some time, and it involves Donald Trump, the White House, and right-wing terror. So Donald Trump recently has downplayed concerns over white supremacy. Since this weekend's mass shootings, he said that he's against white supremacy and all other supremacies because there's so many and they're all equal these days. And that's terrible, obviously. And we know that previously, after white supremacists have committed terror attacks, he's downplayed the significance of the threat, either in the US or internationally. And it seems like, man, these are some real gaffes, or maybe he's a real dick. But it's worse than that. It's a sort of concerted effort going back literally years to disarm the US government against dealing with what they acknowledge is the biggest terror threat coming our way. So we wanna show you some details. This is coming from a senior Trump administration source. Get a load of this. Homeland Security officials battled the White House for more than a year to get them to focus more on domestic terrorism. The White House wanted to focus only on the jihadist threat, which, while serious, ignored the reality that racial supremacist violence was rising fast here at home. They had major ideological blinders on. So this is a source from deep within the Trump administration saying, by the way, this is a conservative, this is a Republican who also thinks that jihadists are one of the principal threats that we face domestically. So understand this is not some leftist or anything, but this source was there to see this battle play out, and we've got some specifics for you. So to give you an idea of, I alluded to some of the past times that he's sort of played both sides or helped to, I guess, obfuscate the threat. One of the worst examples was in March of this year, right after the slaughter of 51 Muslims in New Zealand, Trump said he didn't think white nationalism was a rising threat around the world. I don't really, he said. I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. And imagine that after any other terror attack, that the president would come out and say, you guys are taking this way too seriously. It's, yeah, sure, 51 people died, but a small group of people, you can't even fill a football stadium with them, as Tucker Carlson would say. And so here's some more of how that's played out inside of the US government. The former senior administration official noted that the White House, specifically the president, has a problem criticizing white supremacy and says he, quote, didn't have expectation they would get behind it. Now, this is a reference to a brief mention of domestic terrorism as a threat in the national counterterrorism strategy. Quote, because the preponderance of it involves white supremacy. And that's not something this administration is comfortable speaking out against until the other day by the president. And even that was pretty hedged. So that was referring to the milquetoast teleprompter comments that Trump had clearly not read and his heart wasn't in it. So this is a guy who worked for Trump on these issues. Career is around dealing with terrorism and says, we can't get even a brief acknowledgement of this threat in official documentation, even though our intelligence services are acknowledging that this is a serious problem, because Donald Trump is uncomfortable criticizing white supremacy. And so before we press on, for any of you non-hardcore leftists who are watching this, just really, think for a second about what that means. I'm not saying Trump is a white supremacist. I mean, I do all the time, but I'm not right now. Because I know that you don't think that, and you don't think that he identifies that way. But you have to start to wonder, it's obviously a thing. This guy in El Paso clearly was a white supremacist. And so why can't Trump, who's not a white supremacist in your eyes, feel comfortable criticizing a mass murderer who doesn't share his ideology? Isn't that a little bit weird? Isn't that strange? Like if some Green New Deal activist or whatever said, you know what, the threat of climate change is so seriously that it's so serious. The only way we're going to do something about it is if we take drastic action. And so I'm going to start murdering the CEOs of fossil fuel companies. And then this person went and killed a bunch of them. Now, I am not that sort of environmentalist, right? But wouldn't it be weird if I felt uncomfortable criticizing them? If I were like, well, you know, let's just not talk about it. Let's talk about other sorts of threats against CEOs. Wouldn't you start to wonder why exactly that is and start to question my belief that I don't associate with that person? Would it really convince you? But anyway, this is not just a thing about Trump, but it's not just a thing about criticizing this particular terrorist threat. As important as that is, it actually goes deeper than that. Before we get to how money has been allocated and not allocated based on this bias, take a look at this insane sentence. So during a lengthy back and forth, the senior source tells CNN, one White House official proposed that the national counterterrorism strategy focus on radical Islamists and foreign drug dealers. There's a mistake in the original quote, that's not us. Since that would please the president. So, okay, look. This is just one source and it's an anonymous source, so you know, take that as you will. But that person acknowledges that our official terrorism documentation that is used both within the government and is also read outside of the government should be designed to please the president, not to safeguard the country, not to, you know, represent an honest critique of the threats that we face and a serious response that's up to the task of facing that threat, to please the president. Because he gets uncomfortable when you talk about white supremacy. He doesn't like criticizing it. He doesn't even like when other people criticize it. He doesn't even like when other people criticize it just within the confines of a document that he himself is never going to read. How bothered by something do you have to be to have the actual content of that report written to avoid that? And the issue, of course, is that this is not just about acknowledging the threat, as serious as that is. It's not just about not talking about the threat, as serious as that is. Take a look at this from Parker Malloy, highlighting a couple of the important points there. So on May 10th of 2017, giving an idea of how far back this goes, the DHS and the FBI issued a memo titled, white supremacist extremism poses persistent threat of lethal violence. So this is back when they actually could write documents like that. The month after that, grant money to fund the program was cut. So after the DHS and the FBI acknowledged that this is a serious problem, they're like, acknowledged, we're cutting your funding. Not even keeping it steady, which would itself be a dereliction of duty. The duty of the president and the federal government to protect the American people. But they actually cut the money. I mean, think about all the QAnon people and the conspiracy theories that they have. Think about all the conspiracy theories that we remember from back during the Obama years. How desperately those people could have hoped to come up with something like this to show that a president not only won't protect us, but in fact disarms those who aim to protect us. That would have been this graphic, that Parker Malloy tweet, if it was about Obama and if the year was 2015, that would have been burned into the screens of everyone watching Fox News because it would have been up for 9 months straight. But here, was that the biggest scandal yesterday when that came out? I don't even know, was it top five? I'm not actually sure. And yet it is perhaps the clearest evidence that the Trump administration and the Republicans in general, the reason that they are in power, the main effect that comes from that is tax cuts first and foremost. And then after that, making sure that America cannot respond to the threats that we face. If it's threats to our democracy, our ability to have free and fair elections, they want to disarm us. They want to make sure that there's no reforms. If it's gun violence, they want to make sure that we're not even getting background checks out of this. So forget that idea, but we're certainly not going to get an assault weapons ban or anything like that. So again, it's disarm, disarm, disarm. If every one of the experts is saying that domestic terrorism, that's the big threat, and the form it comes in is far right white supremacist terrorism, then they disarm us. They disband those groups, they cut the funding. How is that not the dominant message throughout this presidential campaign? For every one of these people, many of them Republicans, who vote based on their fears, their concerns about their safety, that the people they put into power are there to make sure that they are unsafe. And yet you don't hear talk about it. I barely saw that spread outside of Parker and a few others on Twitter that was barely even mentioned. Complete dereliction of duty. Anyway, I want to move on to a slightly more ridiculous, something that came out of this. So Donald Trump has had an issue recently with Fox News. He's attacked them a number of times. We're going to go over some of the history of that. But now he's got it in for Shep Smith. So he tweeted this recently. Watching fake news CNN is better than watching Shepard Smith, the lowest rated show on Fox News. Actually, whenever possible, I turn to OANN. So he definitely doesn't like Shep Smith. But he dislikes Shep Smith so much that he's even willing to throw Fox News under the bus in favor of this other organization that he probably doesn't even watch as much as they beg him to. And you can Google that, it's pretty funny. But then the question is, what did Shep Smith do that got Donald Trump, a guy who was supposedly a little bit busy yesterday? I mean, he was flying around the country meeting the survivors of terror attacks when he had time to message that. Well, so there's this. Shep Smith responded to Tucker Carlson saying that white supremacy is not a serious issue. You can take a look at this headline. He says that without a question, it's a serious problem. And so there Shep is attacking Tucker Carlson, a guy who is much closer ideologically to Donald Trump. But within that criticism of Tucker Carlson, he also criticized the president, saying that the fact that Trump was made time to attack Joe Biden, to criticize the ratings that we would have, that everyone would have, if Joe Biden was president, was certainly below the dignity of the president. That probably is what it is. I mean, the fact that Shep Smith also thinks that we should do something about white supremacy certainly didn't help. But he criticized the president, and that led to Donald Trump being willing to not only set Shep Smith on fire, but the entire network as well. Now, just for one second, a little bit of fun. Shep Smith, he had his show actually after he was attacked, interestingly enough. And so here's what he did with his time.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. It's nice to have you with us. We're being watched, as you know.
Who's watching us?
Well, a number of people. Some of them are not too happy, which is too bad.
That's, you know, Shep Smith, within the confines of Fox News, I don't think he gets to have fun very often. So he found time to have a little bit of fun. While, by the way, I don't watch Shep Smith, they still have those gigantic tablets in back of him. What the hell is that? Did you see that, Edwin? I don't know what that's supposed to be. Is that like a weird idea of like a sci-fi movie? Like, what would the future be like in 50 years? Well, I think we'll have iPad Pros. No, that's not what the future looks like. Are they actually working or are they just actors? I'm not actually sure. But anyway, this is important because while you shouldn't watch Fox News, you shouldn't even watch Shep Smith. Of Fox News, Shep Smith is literally the only person, maybe Chris Wallace, three times a year, who is willing to criticize the president, to fact check the president, and to reflect reality at least occasionally. So look, just a month ago, Shep Smith described Trump's attacks on a group of minority congresswomen as a misleading and xenophobic eruption of distraction and division. That is what every other reasonable person was saying, but he was just about the only person saying it on Fox News. And so that is valuable that he's there. And it's interesting because Donald Trump definitely, he wants Fox News, he needs Fox News. As important as Breitbart and 4chan and 8chan are to him, and as popular as they are amongst his followers, Fox News is still the principal way that you communicate with a couple of million conservatives every day. And yet that relationship is getting increasingly shaky. Trump recently, after the network aired a F Trump chant from a bar in France, he said that Fox News was changing fast and forgetting the people who got them there. I don't think that that's actually what Fox News is doing. I think it was just a slip up, but it's going to be interesting to see during this election how Fox News will treat Donald Trump. I mean, they obviously want him to stay in power, but if he starts to do really poorly, if it looks like he's going to fail, I wonder if they're going to try to plan for the post-Trump Republican Party and what that might look like, or are they going to follow him into the abyss? Either way, check in every once in a while with Shep Smith because he'll probably have the most interesting take on it. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. Dave Leventhal is going to be joining us once again to talk about Donald Trump and his unpaid police bills after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So Donald Trump made it back to El Paso this week, but what hasn't made it to El Paso is the money that he owes them for the police protection that he's received earlier this year. This has been a big issue and a big sum of money. And so we're joined once again by Dave Leventhal, the Center for Public Integrity, to break down this particular issue for Trump. Dave, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you.
Good to have you here. So we've talked about this earlier this year, that he owed quite a bit of money, or his campaign at least owed quite a bit of money, and it hadn't been paid. Can you bring people up to speed on that?
So Donald Trump owes the city of El Paso, at least as far as the city of El Paso is concerned, $569,000 stemming from a Make America Great Again rally that Donald Trump had conducted back in February. It was about $470,000 worth of initial police and public safety related bills. And then they tacked on a late fee when Donald Trump's campaign didn't pay it. The bottom line is that Donald Trump's campaign doesn't pay any of the many bills that municipalities across the country sometimes send him for police and public safety related costs. We've reached out to the Trump campaign on numerous occasions. They refuse to explain themselves, haven't returned any of our messages in regards to that. And it's kind of an issue where some presidential candidates do pay these sort of bills. Other candidates don't pay these sort of bills. And there's no federal law that actually mandates that they do unless there's some sort of a contract signed ahead of time. And those really only happen and come to pass when rallies such as this, campaign rallies, are being conducted on city property, which in the case of Donald Trump's El Paso rally, it was not.
I don't understand how there could be no legal ramification. Like, if I owed the police $50, I'm sure that would become an issue in my life. He owes $500,000. So look, you mentioned there that this is not just an issue specifically to El Paso. We're gonna return to El Paso, but do we have any kind of idea of the total sum of money that he or his campaign owe across the country?
And we totaled it up back in June, and at that point, it was almost $850,000 across 10 different municipalities, ranging from Lebanon, Ohio, to Erie, Pennsylvania, to Mesa, Arizona, and of course, El Paso, which makes us back in the news by virtue of Donald Trump going there just yesterday to meet with folks who have been, of course, affected by the very tragic shooting that happened on Saturday in El Paso. So Donald Trump did not address this. We spoke to El Paso officials yesterday. The campaign, Donald Trump's campaign, didn't pay this outstanding bill when Donald Trump came to El Paso yesterday. And as of today, it remains to be unpaid as alongside with all the other bills that Donald Trump owes, according to the cities that say that he owes those bills.
In advance of him arriving in El Paso, did anyone in the government raise this as an issue? Was anyone pushing for him to not be invited back as long as he was owing? I mean, not just the government, not just randomly, but specifically the police, the people who protect him in case there's violence at his rally, in case there's a shooting or something like that. These are people who are willing to lay down their lives to protect Donald Trump. He's stiffing them. Did anyone raise that as a concern?
There's a whole host of folks who have raised this as concern. Dee Margo, the mayor of El Paso, when I spoke to him earlier this year, he said this is an issue of personal credibility and that Donald Trump should absolutely pay this bill. We don't know at this point, because there were some private interludes, whether any El Paso officials specifically pushed this point when Donald Trump was in El Paso yesterday, but officials there have made it very clear all along that they want Donald Trump to pay this bill. And they want him to pay this bill not just because they think that he should, but because it has an effect on the city services that they provide. That would pay more than a couple of salaries for El Paso police officials for a full year. Donald Trump oftentimes talks very lovingly about law enforcement officials and police officials. He met with some yesterday. He was very supportive in his words there. basically, their argument is that even though Donald Trump may, by law, not be required, mandated to pay these bills, that he should, out of a moral obligation to the police officials in El Paso and across the country, and that he should do so because there's no reason for him not to. His campaign has a heck of a lot of money on hand. The El Paso bill represents about 1% of what the Trump campaign has cash on hand in its account as of the end of last month, or the end of June, I should say. And that's the argument that El Paso officials are making, and that's what we're hearing from them.
Just out of curiosity, you mentioned that he met with the police representatives. So you mentioned that the government officials there have brought this up. Has there been any concern raised by actual members of the police force, their leadership, or anything like that, either in El Paso or around the country?
For El Paso, that's unclear. I haven't spoken to police officials there. I have spoken to police officials in other jurisdictions where Donald Trump has received bills stemming from his rallies, and they've made the case, too, that it's a matter of public safety. If the police department or sheriff's department is out there protecting Donald Trump because the Secret Service has asked for that type of protection, that they feel like they should be remunerated. They feel that they should get money to offset the oftentimes very significant expenses that are incurred when a presidential political rally comes to town. Now, political officials will make the argument that, hey, you know, we welcome the president, we welcome any political candidate who wants to come to our city or our town. But if it's going to be something that, for example, is a rally that attracts 15 or 20,000 people, and we basically have to send our entire police force out to protect the president, and we don't have much of a choice in the matter, then that's something that we would hope that his campaign would cover, since this is a political rally in nature. The one alternative is that they say, hey, Mr. President, you're not welcome here, but no city is willing to, at least at this point, go that far and basically uninvite the president to their city. Yeah.
Well, look, it's either going to take that sort of pressure, or there's going to have to be popular pressure put onto the campaign. Whether Trump or any other candidate who's not paying these bills, there has to be some sort of consequences. And Donald Trump, he doesn't like paying any bill. He's not going to pay $500,000 unless there's a big international national conversation around it. Dave Leventhal, thank you.
Congress could address this.
What's that?
Congress could address this. They just haven't passed a law to address this, I should note.
Well, hopefully they'll pick that back up. And as always, thank you both on this issue and everything else you join us for. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, John.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. So what do we have in the future of American democracy? Well, if Donald Trump stays in power, and if his base stays a big fan of him, it might be a far more powerful presidency, at least if they get their way. Because support for an unencumbered president, a president who faces decreasing checks from either the Congress or the Supreme Court, that is the direction they are looking to take us in. Let's take a look at a chart. It's complex, there's a lot of bars. Just bear with me. The left four, that's last year. The right four, that's just a month ago. And what you see there is for each of the four sort of ideological breakdowns, what's your support on the top for a president who has expanded powers? So he's not constrained by Congress or the courts. And you see there, I want to take your vision to the darker red one on the top. You can see that moving from 26% approval to 52% approval in just a year, conservative Republicans are shooting up there and thinking that the president might need a little bit more independence. And we don't want to hear so much from that pesky Senate, House of Representatives, or Supreme Court. But again, that's a lot of facts, there's a lot of numbers. So let's break this down. For conservative Republicans, that's at 52% agreeal. That's doubled since last year, 26%, which itself is a double from when President Barack Obama in 2016, when he was last president, from 13%. So over the course of just a couple of years, 3 years, you've gone from 13 to 26 to 52. I got news for you, we can't even double again because there's not enough people to merit it. And so what that represents is a shocking change. I don't know that I've ever seen agreement to a polling question shoot up the way this one has. And what it represents is that Trump supporters, these are like hardcore right wingers, who have their entire lives been incredibly suspicious of the federal government, government power, being tread upon, all of that. So much so that some of them go and join militias and stuff like that. They talk about independence movements and we gotta have our guns in case the government gets too powerful. When it's Trump, then suddenly, well, just let him do what he wants to do. Why are we hearing this stuff about the Congress? So the courts are gonna question what Trump says? We don't have a president, we should have a king. And it's interesting that Donald Trump accidentally referred to the reign of the presidency in a tweet just a couple of days ago. President doesn't reign, a king reigns. But that may be the direction we're headed in. What's interesting too is, I guess, devil's advocate. Like a knee-jerk thing for me would be to assume this is probably what we see all the time. You know, when the Democrat takes over the presidency, then you probably have a lot of Democrats thinking that the president should be unencumbered by these checks and balances. And that's interesting. There is actually a partisan effect if you look back a number of years, but it does not explain what we're seeing right now. If you were to look at the fall, so we just showed you the rise of Republicans. If you look at the fall from Democrats, who in theory, because Donald Trump is president, they should want more checks and balances, you'll see that they are more in favor of checks and balances. It's gone from 29% to 16%. So that's the movement in the direction of wanting more involvement of the other branches of government. But that is nowhere near the change that we've seen on the other side. And that is dangerous. That's dangerous, not just when you take this poll by itself, but in the context of what we've seen, the rhetoric we've seen from Republican politicians, and certainly from these nationalist movements, not just in the United States, but around the globe, where they are increasingly distrustful of democracy, increasingly willing to take away the actual day-to-day involvement of regular people in democracy. Here in the US, to give you a few examples, you not only have people saying that we need something like voter ID, perhaps poll taxes and poll tests and things like that. You not only have people who want to shut down as many polling places as possible, you also have a movement to end the direct election of senators, which seems insane. Most people probably just think that that's always the way it's been here in the US. But of course, if you're a student of American history, it's not. At one point they were chosen, now they're elected. They want to get rid of that too. Like, we're talking about possibly amending the Electoral College to give the people more of a say in the presidency. No, we're not just not going to be able to move forward. They want to take us back decades and decades. And here's the thing, they want Donald Trump to give them what he has promised. They're willing to jettison not only the Democrats in Congress and the libs on the Supreme Court, but also the Republicans in Congress. I mean, they have a majority of the Senate. But even then, they don't want the involvement of that. These are the Republican senators that they've elected around the country. Get rid of them. The fact that we have a conservative majority in the Supreme Court, that's not good enough. They don't want the court. Even though Trump has had an outsized influence on it already, even that doesn't give them any remaining respect for the Supreme Court. And this is something that I think that we as a country need to deal with. I know that we've got a million emergencies that we're dealing with at any given time. But the idea that this movement, which has prided itself as its core in being suspicious of concentrated power, that those concerns are fading away in just a couple of short years at a rate that, like I said, I've never seen before, that should be extremely worrisome. I know that political scientists are talking about this, they're researching this and all of that. But it's on us as citizens, if we want to have a democracy, if we want to make our democracy not just in name, but in effect in the future, we have to watch out for this. We have to persuade some of these people that moving this direction is a very dangerous direction for our country. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, activist who's facing jail time for her activism is gonna join us here in the studio, break down what she and her group have been up to after this. The right to protest is supposed to be baked into the DNA of our country. It's one of the ways that we express what it is that we care about. But in a number of places throughout the United States, there have been attempts to criminalize protest. Internationally, did you know that environmentalists have a greater individual chance of dying than soldiers do? And so activism, protest comes at an increasing cost. And we have a person on the show joining us right now who's going to talk about that cost so far. Priya Sahani, open rescue investigator and social justice activist, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, I'm so excited to be on.
Great to have you here. So we've talked with members of your organization in the past, we've shown video of some of your direct action efforts. But tell us about what you've been up to and the legal consequences that you might face.
Yeah, so I am one of six open rescue investigators who is currently facing felony charges. And just last week I was arraigned in Sonoma County for an eighth felony charge, and that one is a felony conspiracy for simply standing on public property of a massive duck slaughterhouse, a farm and slaughterhouse, where 1 million ducks are killed every single year. And so, you know, I was part of an action just a few months ago in May where As you can see, activists locked themselves down actually to this very conveyor belt and tried to rescue these animals. And in the process of doing that, one of them actually almost got killed. Mm-hmm. And there was a team of another team which rescued 32 ducklings from this farm. And you know, the reason, John, that we go on to farms and slaughterhouses and facilities like this is because we have tried every single other avenue to address the criminal animal cruelty that's happening. Mm-hmm. We've written letters. We've tried to sit down and talk to the district attorney. We've tried to talk to the police officers, but there's just radio silence. So mm-hmm. when we see this whistleblower footage of these ducklings who literally can't stand, they're collapsed under their own body weight, we have to do something about it. We finally just take action into our own hands. And what we've seen time and time again is that despite our efforts to try to have a conversation, we end up in situations where activists are, not only arrested, but they're also criminalized. Mm-hmm. And for doing what? Standing on public property and for trying to address criminal animal cruelty in California.
So I'm confused. On one level, I'm confused. On another level, I have a suspicion of why exactly this is going on. But you were on public property. So what's the justification for the charges? It seems like it would be on its face inadmissible. I imagine that there's probably some sort of connection between these corporations and those enforcing the law in the area. So what are they saying? What's their justification?
Well, the reason that I'm being charged along with five of my co-defendants is because they're saying that we're conspiring and that, you know, it's just sort of like a charge that you throw on when actually that's my friend Wayne right there getting arrested mm-hmm. for simply standing on public property. He looks so confused, and that's because
he looks pretty conspiratorial.
Yeah, so the reason that they're doing this is because they see us as what they call the head of the snake. They see us as mm-hmm. Leading this effort. But what they don't realize is that the animal rights movement is growing beyond just people like myself or Wayne or other people who've been doing open rescues for the last few years. Mm-hmm. And so they throw these charges, felony conspiracy, because they think, well, if we get the small group of people that's leading this, we're going to stop it. But yeah. What they don't realize is that global lockdowns, people are happening all across the world. Open rescues, people going inside of farms and slaughterhouses is happening from India to Australia to Belgium to France.
So, okay, let's talk now about some of what you're saying is deception on the part of those who are lodging these charges against you in terms of violence and threats. So they're saying that some of the people who'd taken part in this action had been violent, had been starting fights or something like that. And you're saying that that's not only not true, but actually hiding the fact that the threats were coming from the other side.
Yeah, so very ironically, in September of last year, at this point, Sonoma County has released two press releases basically saying that activists have been, assaulting farm owners and whatnot. The irony of that is that not only is there no evidence that that didn't happen, mm-hmm. I was there. We were holding.
There's a lot of cameras.
Yeah, present. There's a lot of cameras. We're holding white flowers in our hands, and people are being, singing and basically trying to help animals. We're busy doing that. And so, not only is there no evidence that that didn't happen, but in fact, we have footage of farm owners basically threatening activists and saying, like, we're going to run you over. And even one of the farm mm-hmm. owners at Paloma Poultry basically saying, like, hey, is there anyone I can pay to run these activists over? Yelling. Homophobic slurs, and I saw this firsthand at Petaluma Poultry last year, where my friends and I basically had to get out of the way because one of the owners of the farm was just full force driving the golf carts towards us, and we're just we've trained ourselves, so we know that we're going to be in situations like this, but we know that even if we're met with violence, that we have to not carry the spirit of nonviolence with us, and we're just there to help the animals.
Yeah, I just want to focus one second on the particular nature of the threat that you face, that he either wanted to run you down or wanted someone else to run you down. So that by itself is a threat that you would think there'd be some sort of legal consequences for. But in other actions outside of this topic area where people have blocked highways and things like that, there have been calls from right-wing pundits to allow people to drive through the crowd if they want to. Not to mention the fact that Heather Hare was killed by a person driving their car. So protesters have been targeted in this particular way before. It almost seems like those words are chosen carefully to scare you as much as possible. And so you also talked about the fact that one person was nearly killed during this action. So, what is it like being involved in these actions, knowing that there's a possibility that you could be the targets of violence, that something could go wrong? Mm-hmm. What is that like?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really scary. And I mean, from getting arrested to wondering, like, am I gonna get shot today? Like, these are realistic things that we prepare for. But I think one of the things that keeps us going is we look at the violence that the animals are facing, and they don't have a choice. They don't have the ability to stand up for themselves and to expose what's happening to them. So we are very willing to take these risks because we know that if we don't do it, if we don't blow the whistle on these corporations, then nobody else will. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of another corporation, so earlier this year you had another direct action that led to some issues for you involving Jeff Bezos. Yes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so right after the action where at the Duck Slaughterhouse, we went to Las Vegas because we heard about Jeff Bezos, who was going to be at a conference. And Petaluma Poultry is an Amazon supplier, so you can buy their products on Amazon. And you know, we all know that Jeff Bezos is the richest man in this world. I mean, just a few days ago, we're hearing about how he's enjoying a nice vacation on his like 3-mile-long yacht. And you know, at some point, we have to hold these powerful individuals accountable. And so we had this opportunity, and I was able to get inside of this conference. And I went up to him with a flower, and my goal was to offer him a flower and say, "Hey, Jeff, you're the richest man on this planet. You're talking at this conference about environmental, devastation. You have a chance to do something about this, and more importantly, a chance to help animals. If you want, right now, you could stop animal cruelty at Amazon and be such a, and that would make such a, you know, the world's difference." And instead of obviously getting an in-depth response, quickly I was, escorted out by security guards. Actually, there's a photo where one of the security guards is reaching into his pocket, and I was like, "Whoa, what's gonna happen?" It's a little scary. I'm just here with a flower. But I spent 3 days in Las Vegas jail for that action, and yes. They charged me with 2 felonies and 1 misdemeanor, and I still have the misdemeanor.
Wow. Okay. And as you point out, he's the richest man. He could lead a 100% ethical like leadership of his business. All of that, pay his workers a living wage, all of that, and still be the wealthiest person in the history of the world.
And still be the wealthiest person. Who knows? Amazon is a globe at this point. Like, you know, people look to Amazon as like, "Wow, what's this company doing?" And so they could set a really, really powerful example. And one of the things that's really interesting is, you know, we always hear from companies like, "Well, we don't even know this farm. We don't know anything about this." But the interesting thing is, like, you have more of a connection with this farm than I do as someone who doesn't even consume animal products. So why is it that I'm able to go inside and say, like, "Hey, I'm going to take responsibility for these animals that are suffering inside," while you're just like, you know, "Hey, I have nothing to do with this," even though you are literally profiting off of the bodies of these animals.
So if someone's watching this and they want more information about either the organization or how they can get involved, what should they do?
Yeah, we are actually going to be converging in California. So if any of the things that people are hearing are inspiring you, come to California for what we're calling the Animal Liberation California Convergence, where activists are going to be getting trained to take action like this. And even if you're not an animal rights activist and you want to learn how to blow the whistle on corporations, this is the place for you. And you can go to type in the URL dxe.io/ALCC. You can sign up and register for the conference. And and you know, one of the things that I'm hoping to do in the next year is to make it legal for Californians to go onto farms and slaughterhouses and rescue animals. And what we're calling that is the right to rescue. So I'm hoping that hopefully if I'm here back over here in a year, I can be telling you about how we legally established the right to rescue in California, because I'm facing felony charges, 8 felony charges, and I'm excited to go to trial. So look out for that. And hopefully we can give every single Californian a legal right to enter these facilities and rescue animals. Just like, I know, John, you would probably break open a car window if you saw a dog trapped in, you know, a car on a hot day.
That's even if it wasn't a hot day, I'd even if it was the dog, honestly.
Yeah, even if it wasn't.
I'm not
going to
be stopped by glass.
Exactly, and that's what we're trying to do for all animals. They're just not in. They're not dogs, and they're not in. They're not in cars. They're in farms and slaughterhouses.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're successful in that effort. I look forward to you not going to jail. And Prius, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break here, and we come back news from around the world. And now it's time for news from around the world, and meanwhile in. Yeah, around the world, Amnesty International has now released a travel advisory warning saying that those traveling to the United States could well be shot. Let's take a look at this image. That's what they sent out with a ton of helpful tips for people who are thinking about traveling to the dangerous, rugged outback that is the US of A. Yeah, our violence has gotten so bad that you have to be warned against it. The organization urged travelers, quote, to exercise extreme caution when traveling throughout the country due to rampant gun violence, adding that gun violence is so prevalent in the US that it amounts to a human rights crisis, which seems like an accurate reflection of what's going on here. Ernest Coverson of Amnesty International said, people in the US cannot reasonably expect to be free from harm. A guarantee of not being shot is impossible, which might be the saddest sentence that I've seen in some time. It also says this, a traveler's race, country of origin, ethnic background, sexual orientation, or gender identity may place them at higher risk after recent attacks linked to white supremacist ideology. Again, 100% true. It would be nice if our government would communicate in as honest and forthright a fashion as Amnesty International does. But they're acknowledging all of the threats that our government refuses to. Finally, by the way, so that's Amnesty International, but this is actually something that's been happening. Venezuela and Uruguay issued travel warnings of their own to their citizens following the mass shootings. We know that at the same time this week, Mexico is considering attempting to extradite the shooter from El Paso, who of course targeted both Mexican Americans and Native Mexicans as well. So that's the state of the world. Donald Trump goes and says that he's restored respect for the US on the international stage. But we can't go for respect. We're just going for people to be willing to come here and expecting that they probably won't be murdered. Meanwhile, in while on the moon, they've got some new visitors, tardigrades. You familiar with tardigrades? We'll show you some pictures. But how did they get there, these creatures? Well, a group called the there you go, there's a tardigrade. Looks weird, it's not that big. It's actually really, really small. And thank God, because that would definitely be the dominant species on our Earth if they were that big. So this is a group called the Arch Mission Foundation. So there was this space probe, and they had installed a library of sorts on the craft. The library was etched onto a nickel metal disc. It contained nearly all of English Wikipedia, copies of classic books, human blood samples, and tardigrades. And so when it crashed onto the moon, the idea is that all of that stuff will now be there for forever, possibly, for aliens to find, maybe. The blood's not gonna come back or anything, but the tardigrades just might, because these are tiny little creatures that are incredibly resilient to pretty much any attempt to destroy them. They can form bubbly cysts around their bodies, like puffer jackets. The cysts allow them to survive in harsh climates. In dry conditions, they shrink down into a protective pill shape called a tun. In this state, they can survive without water or being trapped in ice for literally decades and then be revived. They're able to withstand pressure, for instance, 6 times worse than the pressure you'd find at the deepest reaches of Earth's oceans. And they can also slow their metabolism by 99.99%. They live in our ocean, they live in the soil of every continent, every climate, and in every latitude, and now even on satellites orbiting our planet. We don't know for sure that they survived the crash, we don't know for sure that they'll ever be recovered, but if they can, that's pretty amazing. And if not, perhaps they will start to evolve there on the moon's surface, and someday we will come to love our tardigrade overlords. Meanwhile, Greenland has been the site of record melt. We're gonna show you an image in just a second, but first you should understand that last month there was a heat wave that scorched the entirety of the ice sheet. On one day, it lost 12.5 billion tons to surface melting, the largest single day loss in recorded history, going back all the way to 1950 when we started measuring this. That was the worst day ever. In just 2 days, from July 31st to August 1st, they lost enough ice to cover Florida in 5 inches of water. They lost 60 billion tons of ice in just 1 week. But let's bring up the video, just show you a few seconds of what this looks like. This is not like a casual melt. This is torrential. This is rivers melting. Now, some of that will come back once we get into the winter, but this is record breaking and that is noteworthy. At some point, Greenland might indeed be green, and that is not a future we should be working for as humans. Okay, thank you everybody for watching. I wish we had more time to talk about both Greenland and all the other news. If you haven't already reviewed the podcast, please go on and do that. There's been great ones. TDR Rock says, love Brooke. John handles business like a boss. Best show on the TYT network. Very nice of you. I'd love to see more reviews. If you like the podcast, that's the only way more people are going to find it. Thank you, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.